From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Ross Perot files a suit today over his exclusion from the presidential debates. We'll speak with Alan Lichtman, author of The Keys to the White House, a surefire guide to predicting the next president, about the role of third parties throughout U.S. history. The battle over public education. New York City's Republican mayor has been toying with a controversial proposal to send 1,000 public school students to Catholic schools. We'll have a debate. And Clinton's got the Macarena, Dole's got I'm a Dole Man, and now a theme song for Ralph Nader's campaign. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bill Clinton was greeted by about a dozen protesters as his motorcade arrived for morning services at Foundry United Methodist Church yesterday. The demonstration was one of several planned in various cities by the gay advocacy group ACT UP in retaliation for the president signing a bill that in effect denies federal recognition of same-sex marriages. He signed the Defense of Marriage Act into law early Saturday after flying home from a four-day campaign trip to six states. The president plunges back into the frenzy of his reelection campaign this week. Following an address to the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday, he's scheduled to campaign in New Jersey, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Houston, Fort Worth, Texas, Providence, Rhode Island, Boston, and New Hampshire. Meanwhile, in Saturday's Democratic primary in Hawaii, Democratic Congressmember Patsy Mink withstood attacks on her views on same-sex marriage to win nomination for reelection, joining fellow incumbent Neil Abercrombie on the general election ballot. Mink said she opposed same-sex marriage but voted against the Defense of Marriage Act, which prevents the federal recognition of same-sex marriages. Mink said she opposed the act because she believed it was unconstitutional. Her opponent charged she was trying to play both sides of the issue. Neil Abercrombie, also a Democrat, picked up 72% of the primary vote. He will face Republican Orson Swindle, the national spokesman for Ross Perot's 1992 presidential campaign in November. Swindle lost a close race with Abercrombie in 1994. Bob Dole was campaigning in Grays Lake, Illinois, a distant suburb north of Chicago. He marked the third anniversary of President Clinton's health care speech yesterday by asserting that his rival might take another shot at a government takeover of health care if reelected. At the GOP rally, Dole said, "Now the election is right around the corner, so President Clinton will do everything he can to hide his liberal agenda. But if you have any doubt where he'd like to take America, just think back to 3 years ago today, September 22, 1993. That was the day Bill Clinton told Congress that the federal government should be in charge of health care." Clinton's health care proposal failed, marking one of the president's lowest points of his administration. This international news, the U.S. airlift to Kuwait is over. The last of the 3,000 soldiers President Clinton ordered to the emirate arrived yesterday. The Army says they're now setting up camps near the Iraqi border, joining 1,200 soldiers who've been conducting war games since August. But some sailors in the region could be home sooner. The Pentagon is considering withdrawing one of two aircraft carriers now deployed in the Persian Gulf. Defense Chief William Perry says if things don't flare again, the USS Carl Vinson could leave the Middle East in October and return to its home port in Bremerton, Washington. Turkey's Islamist prime minister yesterday denied Turkey had encouraged Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to assert control of northern Iraq and crush separatist Turkish Kurds based there. The foreign minister, Tansu Çiller, was interviewed by the New York Times on Saturday. She was quoted as saying Ankara would drop its plan to create a so-called security zone inside Iraq if President Saddam Hussein took steps to crush Turkish Kurds waging a guerrilla war against Turkey from camps in northern Iraq. The newspaper said senior U.S. administration officials were dismayed by the remarks. Turkey announced plans early in September to create a security zone in northern Iraq up to 6 miles deep, and Washington said it would not object if Ankara went ahead with the scheme. This news from Moscow, a senior doctor preparing President Boris Yeltsin for heart surgery, cast doubt on whether the Russian president would survive an early operation, but the Kremlin maintained a strict silence on his remarks. The communist speaker of Russia's State Duma, lower house of parliament, said today President Boris Yeltsin should consider retiring if doctors rule he is unfit for heart surgery and ask him to cut down on his activity. A council of doctors is expected to meet on Wednesday and decide whether Yeltsin is fit for surgery. Meanwhile, today, a news conference is scheduled where a former DEA agent will describe how and when he was stationed at a U.S. airbase in Latin America. He discovered and documented an effort to smuggle drugs into the United States to fund the Nicaraguan Contras. The unidentified agent will be joined by civil rights activist Dick Gregory and talk show host Joe Madison, who are calling for an investigation into allegations that the CIA planted illegal drugs in minority areas of Los Angeles in order to fund the Contras. Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters has already officially called for a congressional hearing into the matter. And Ross Perot saying Bob Dole and Republicans will suffer for denying him a seat at the presidential debates is going to court to force a reversal of that decision. We will not just sit by, he vowed yesterday. The Texas billionaire, the nominee for his own Reform Party, said he would file a lawsuit today seeking an injunction against sponsorship of the debates by the Commission on Presidential Debates. The commission, made up equally of Republicans and Democrats, but no independents, ruled that Perot should not join the debates because he doesn't have a realistic chance to win. In debate negotiations, the Dole campaign got the Clinton camp to agree to exclude Perot, too. Said Perot, Senator Dole did something really dumb politically, and that is he poisoned the attitudes of millions of independent voters who put the Republicans in power in the House and Senate. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Negotiators for President Clinton and Republican Bob Dole have agreed that the two men will debate twice without Reform Party nominee Ross Perot. According to the schedule to be finalized tomorrow, the 90-minute debates are set for Sunday, October 6th in Hartford, Connecticut, Wednesday, October 16th in San Diego, the second a town hall-style forum. Vice presidential candidates Al Gore and Jack Kemp will face off Wednesday, October 9th in St. Petersburg, Florida. But again, there will be no third-party candidates. We're now joined by our national affairs correspondent, Larry Bensky, out at our Pacifica station in Berkeley, KPFA, to discuss third-party politics throughout U.S. history, and also an author who is joining us, Alan J. Lichtman, is here to talk about predicting the next president. We welcome Professor Alan Lichtman, who teaches at American University.
Good morning.
Before we talk about these surefire keys you have to predicting the next president, I found your chapter on third parties in the United States extremely important. Can you talk about the history of third parties? Right now, we're seeing an attempt to exclude third parties from all presidential discussion.
Well, exclusionary efforts by the major parties when it comes to third parties is nothing new in American history. In many ways, America has the best of all worlds. We've had a stable political system for more than 200 years, an extraordinary accomplishment in a nation this diverse. Now, that system generally has been dominated by two parties, but third parties have been critical to maintaining that stability. They've served as outlets of discontent, and they have brought forth issues well in advance of the major parties, issues that have become fundamental to the American political system. For example, it was the Free Soil Party in the 1840s that first proposed the idea of restricting the spread of slavery. It was third parties in the late 19th century that first proposed woman suffrage, decades before the major parties adopted woman suffrage. It was progressive parties in the early 20th century, under the leadership of ex-president Theodore Roosevelt and others, that proposed for the first time before the major parties things such as minimum wages, regulation of child labor, collective bargaining rights for labor. And it was Wallace's 1968 campaign that set many of the themes that were to become the hallmark of so-called conservative populism that were picked up by the Republican Party. Low taxes, deregulation, states' rights, opposition to the so-called pointy-headed bureaucrats in Washington were all issues put forth with great force by George Wallace in 1968.
But weren't these parties, Professor, very different from, let's say, the Reform Party, specifically of Ross Perot, in the sense that they were parties, they were broadly based, they did have a mandate, they weren't top-down organizations funded by a multi-billionaire?
The answer is yes and no. Some parties were, in fact, broad-based, long-lasting parties. I call them in my book the perennials, the Socialist Party, the Prohibitionist Party, for example. Others, however, although they were not financed by billionaires, were pretty much one-shot campaigns by prominent presidential candidates. For example, in 1912, the Progressive Party that got the largest vote of any third party in presidential elections was a party pretty much created by Theodore Roosevelt, ex-president, after he had failed to wrest the Republican nomination from William Howard Taft in 1912. He actually finished second. He beat out Taft with 27% of the vote. As we know, the Wallace Party was pretty much a creation of George Wallace and really died out after his presidential ambitions as a third-party candidate disappeared. The Progressive Party of 1924 pretty much died after the presidential candidacy of Bob La Follette. So for the most part, in fact, with some exceptions like the Socialist Party, the Prohibitionist Party, today's Libertarian Party, third-party efforts have been very much centered around a charismatic leader and a presidential candidate. In many ways, what makes Ross Perot a little bit different, of course, is the money and the fact that he is trying to transform his one-shot effort in 1992 into a second shot and into an enduring reform party.
In fact, no, I was just going to say...
He isn't really succeeding in doing that, is he? I mean, he has done everything he can. If you read the book by Gerald Posner and other studies of Ross Perot over the last 4 years, to assure that the party remains under his control and is not an enduring party. And in fact, many people have quit the party, charging him with doing just that.
Well, there are a number of problems with any kind of third party becoming an enduring party. Overwhelmingly, the biggest problem is we have a winner-take-all political system. That is, to get elected as a member of Congress, or for the most part, even as a member of a state legislature or a county or municipal government, you got to win an election outright. You don't get points just for your percentage, and that's very hard against the major parties. It's also difficult for third parties to get money. That said, you're absolutely right. A problem with Ross Perot's third party is that it does tend to be top down. It remains to be seen whether it gains widespread grassroots support. On the other hand, the fact that it does have Ross Perot with his recognition and his money does perhaps better position it than any party recently in American history to become an enduring force. It just hasn't happened for third parties.
Professor Lichtman, you've talked about third parties not having a chance in this country, and yet the Republican Party, as you point out in your book, The Keys to the White House, the Republican Party arose as a third party during the 1850s when the Whig Party disintegrated over the issues of immigration and slavery.
Absolutely correct. It's the one third party that's made it to major party status, but it made it as a major party, not as an enduring third party. It essentially took over after the Whigs destroyed themselves, and for a while it actually competed with a very interesting party called the Know-Nothing Party that was mainly anti-foreign, anti-Catholic-oriented party. But no.
And now we have two Know-Nothing parties, right?
Yeah, well, we may have many Know-Nothing parties. But no third party has ever made it and endured as a force of real clout. Some parties have survived for a very long time, like the Socialist or the Prohibitionist or today's Libertarian Party, but they're not electing vast numbers of public officials compared to the major parties. There are 500,000 public offices in America, most of them partisan, and 99.9% of them are controlled by Democrats and Republicans.
You talk in glowing terms, Professor Lichtman, about the United States political system and its endurance over the last 200 plus years, but of course there are many people who feel left out of that political system, and preliminary estimates are that half the people in the United States who are eligible to vote aren't going to vote this year, and the participation statistics are dismal in the primaries and very dismal in a lot of other local contests around the country. Would this be increased, and would there be more small-d democracy in the United States if there were more parties that were interest-based and then had to form coalitions in order to make a government? And I think specifically of former New York Times columnist Tom Wicker's suggestion in his new book, which you may be familiar with, that African Americans should have their own political party in this country.
Well, you're absolutely right. While we've had a stable system, turnout has greatly declined in the 20th century, and even in presidential elections, it's only about half, and local elections, it's much lower. But this is not been characteristic of the system overall. In the late 19th century, turnout reached as high as 75%. In part, the weak turnout is a result of a weak party system. While we've had two dominant parties, as you say quite correctly, they've not been all that successful in mobilizing a lot of the interests or necessarily all that successful in maintaining themselves as strong and viable organizations. As Martin Wattenberg pointed out in a recent book, we now tend to have candidate-centered parties. There have been many suggestions over time in terms of interest groups forming third parties in America. Women, for example, after gaining suffrage, contemplating forming a broad-based women's party. An African-American party is a possibility. A labor party. However, as long as we have a strict winner-take-all system, not only for the presidency, but for virtually every other office, it is very difficult to have a narrowly based interest party, even one as large as one based on African Americans.
What force do you see that could challenge that winner-take-all system? Because, of course, the politicians themselves are elected by it. They're not going to change it.
You make a very good point, and you'd have to virtually change the Constitution, the laws of many of the states. It's not going to happen without a true grassroots uprising in America. It will never happen from the top down, and right now such a grassroots uprising seems pretty remote.
Do have peasants with pitchforks out here in San Francisco who have put such a measure on the ballot, Professor Lichtman, in November for a proportional election of San Francisco city officials. And there are other groups and organizations around the country that are contemplating getting such things on the ballot. When does it reach a critical mass in your historical mind? If a city like San Francisco passed it, maybe they could be dismissed as those San Francisco liberals. What would have to happen for it to really take off, some sort of proportional representation?
It would have to be adopted in large numbers. You're right. It should start out at the grassroots in municipal and county elections. And it would have to, number one, be adopted in large numbers, and then number two, be picked up as a national movement, kind of get caught up in some kind of, if not a lot of individual national movements, some kind of overall national movement. And it would have to work successfully in cities like San Francisco. And there are some places that do have some kind of proportional representation, but in a country this big so far, it's few and far between.
You know, perhaps no other time than now has it been so nakedly clear the stranglehold that the Democrats and Republicans have over the political system is this bipartisan commission, Republican and Democrat, with no independents, deciding that Ross Perot, Ralph Nader, Harry Brown, and others can't be a part of the presidential debates. This may raise people's ire, especially with, Perot filing a lawsuit today. I'm looking at this Media Studies Center funded by the Freedom Forum report that says a survey of 1,000 voters gives Reform Party candidate Ross Perot even more reason to continue his fight for inclusion in the debates. Live debates are voters' best source of information about the candidates and the campaign. According to this Roper Center survey, almost half of all voters say they learn a lot from watching the candidates debate live. And this was Perot's point yesterday, speaking on television. If he's not in these debates, he cannot pick up his numbers. And he says when people say, look at his numbers from 1992, they were much higher than now, he says that came after the debates. And also this report fiercely criticizes the media for devoting too little attention to third-party and independent candidates. You rarely hear Ralph Nader mentioned, for example.
All great points. I think the Commission on Debates, which is not nonpartisan, it's bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats, made a grievous error. Look, we've traditionally had three debates. Certainly they could have compromised. Two debates, head-on-head, Dole, Clinton, we have that now. Why not a third debate, which lets in not only Ross Perot, but other major third-party candidates? Certainly the country could benefit from hearing views other than Clinton and Dole, and you can predict exactly what Clinton and Dole are going to say. Imagine, though, having their ideas tested against the Natural Law Party, Ralph Nader, the Libertarian Party, and Ross Perot. In fact, I have recommended to the Kennedy Political Union at the American University that we invite at American University Clinton, Dole, and all the major third-party candidates for a debate, and I expect that invitation to go out very soon.
Well, we'll try to broadcast it, I'm sure, if you should manage to get that together.
We're going
to
try.
Just very quickly, Professor, what about Ralph Nader's announced strategy of not being, of being really the anti-Perot type candidate in this race and taking himself as much as possible out of the picture as a personality, being on the ballot in order to build the Green Party and other alternative parties in the 25 or 30 states where he's going to be on the ballot? Is there any historical precedent for that indicating that that would help in the future build a nationwide organization such as the one the Green Party tries to have?
Certainly getting on the presidential ballot and having some kind of broad-based program and grassroots organizing can build an enduring party. Libertarians, although they've not, you know, made a huge dent in terms of electing public officials, has been an enduring party now for 25 years. The Socialist Party, which had, of course, an alternative platform, was an enduring party for many decades. And actually, at one point, believe it or not, in 1912, the Socialist candidate, Eugene Victor Debs, got 5% of the vote. Running from jail in 1920, Debs got a million votes, not quite 5%, but close. So there is some precedent, but again, there's been no example of a third party, except for the Republicans who became a major party, enduring over time and electing large numbers of public officials.
We're talking to Professor Alan Lichtman. He is a political analyst and professor of history at the American University here in Washington, D.C. His latest book is called The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Guide to Predicting the Next President. And we come back after our break. We'll talk about what those keys to predicting the next president are, and then a debate over the privatization of public education. We'll be talking about that just after the first half hour of the show. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman in Washington. Larry Bensky, our national affairs correspondent, joins us from California. And our guest in the studio is Professor Alan Lichtman, a professor at American University. His new book is The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Guide to Predicting the Next President. Okay, what are these keys?
The keys are 13 simple yes-no questions that historically have accounted for every presidential election since 1860. I discovered the keys in 1981, and they have since predicted well ahead of time 1984, 1988, and 1992. 1988, I wrote an article in the Washingtonian magazine when Bush was sinking to a 17-point deficit saying, forget the polls, forget the pundits. Based on history, Bush is a shoo-in to win. And they are basically founded on the theory that presidential elections are referenda on the record of the party in power, and the 13 keys measure the strength and performance of the party in power and determine whether or not the party in power is going to be reelected.
Well, what about just one key, the Ronald Reagan key? Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
That key is reflected in a number of my 13 keys. The way it works, by the way, if the party in power loses six or more of the 13 keys, any six, they're out. Five or fewer, they win. And right now, Bill Clinton has exactly five against him, so he will win in November, except for a lightning strike.
Tell us some of these keys.
Yeah. He mentioned, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Well, I have a long-term economy key, which the party in power wins if real growth during the term is at least equal to the average of the previous two terms. I have a short-term economy key, which the party wins if the economy isn't in recession as you go into the election campaign. I have a social unrest key, which the party in power wins if there isn't sustained social unrest, like we saw in the 1960s. I have a foreign military success key, which the incumbent party wins if they get a big splashy success, like victory in war. Correspondingly, I have a failure key in foreign and military policy, which the party in power wins if they avoid a major disaster, like the fall of China, or the Bay of Pigs, or the Iran hostage crisis. I also have a third party key. We talked about third parties, and they are bad signs for the party in power. The party in power wins the third party key if there is no significant third party campaign, because third party campaigns of a significant nature are, of course, a sign of discontent with how the country is being governed.
Professor Lichtman, let me run an idea by you that I came up with this weekend. I was talking to a local political group out here and talking about increasing voter participation. And I don't know if I'm the first one to come up with this idea, but I did come up with it independently, I think, unless it was subliminal. What if Election Day were switched to April 15th every year and the ballot for whatever offices were included with one's tax returns? Do you think that would have a significant and beneficial effect on the American political system?
I don't think so. The problem is that would skew it to those who file their taxes on April 15th. The election is skewed enough. However, moving it to a weekend would, and, you know, maybe even having balloting over 2 days of a weekend might have a effect of boosting turnout, so would same-day registration, which some states have adopted with a degree of success.
Wouldn't it, though, mean Dole would win, considering people would be so angry on April 15th? They'd go for the man who says, let's get rid of the IRS as we know it.
That's probably true. Republicans would always win if you had it on tax day. They're the
well,
tax
would,
party.
It would force the economic debate, I think, onto a plane of realism, which it now completely lacks. But let me
you
ask
you
a question.
You are an optimist thinking that.
I try to be as optimistic as possible, given the subjects that I generally have to cover. Let me ask you this. The coattails effect.
Yes.
What have you learned over the years? A lot of us now are trying to puzzle out, given what seems to be the inevitable Clinton victory, whether or not the Democrats have a real chance of taking back the House and the Senate, and what, in fact, that would mean. Is it true? Do any of your keys apply this year to indicating to us whether or not the Democrats can get those 20 seats in the House and 7 in the Senate?
My keys don't. They simply tell you whether a candidate's going to win or lose. And by the way, they've been pointing to a Clinton victory since 1994. Even when Clinton was down and out, based on performance, he was still a winner. Aside from the keys, though, my study of history suggests that this is certainly not a surefire guide. But if Clinton wins in double digits, then there is an excellent chance that the Democrats not only take back the House, but also take back the Senate as well. Less than a double-digit victory would make it very difficult for the Democrats to win back both houses. But sometimes, as we saw, for example, in 1984 or with Nixon in 1972, even a big win by the incumbent doesn't have large coattails. But I think this time, it'd be more like 1964 or 1980 when the challenger won by 10 points, Ronald Reagan, and brought large numbers of Republican members of the House and Senate. I think this time, if Clinton wins big, which is quite possible, he will have both houses of Congress, but that could cause all kinds of political problems for Clinton as it did in his first 2 years.
You know, it's interesting you say that third parties hurt the party in power. Now, of course, the party in power in Congress are the Republicans, but the party in power in the White House are the Democrats, and everyone's saying that Perot will actually hurt Dole if he were included in the debates.
Yeah, Dole thinks that, but, you know, as Perot has declined in support, Clinton has increased in support. It's almost, you know, in some polls, a one-to-one correspondence. Moreover, you can't measure the influence of a third party by trying to figure out where the votes come from, because the very fact of a third party is a sign of discontent with how the country is going. And another reason I think Perot has declined in the polls is because things have been going so well during the first half of 1996, really into this fall. I also think Perot, though, has a good point, which is if he gets in the debates, if that were to happen, that would certainly improve his standing and probably to the detriment of Clinton.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University, with your keys to the White House. Do you think it's actually useful? I mean, once you say who's going to win and you say it's predetermined, how helpful is that in the public discourse?
I think it's very helpful because it can turn the public discourse away from the daily spin control and on the big issues. What I've tried to do in this book is bring governance and politics together again and say, look, it's the economy, it's foreign affairs, it's public policy that turn elections, and that's what we should be paying attention to, not the daily spin control and ups and downs that mean nothing.
The Keys to the White House, 1996 is the name of the book, A Surefire Guide to Predicting the Next President. It's out from Madison Books. Alan Lichtman, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be having a debate on public versus private education. But first, we thought we'd bring you this theme song for Ralph Nader's campaign, written by Jeremy Alderson, host of The Nobody Show on WEOS-FM in New York.
Vote for a man who's no good, just 'cause someone tells you you've no choice. There's a man today who stands for good. He will give the voiceless a voice. Nader, Nader, he can lead. Don't matter if we sometimes disagree, 'cause he's honest in word and deed. My God, that's good enough for me. You don't have to toil at a life without hope, so someone else can tell you you're no good. There's a man today who stands for hope. He'll see you get treated like you should. And he says one thing
we don't need
is a government that runs on greed. Don't matter how they do it, you'll be sure to ruin, 'cause it's unsafe at any speed. You don't have to wait to see wrong set to right, just 'cause wrong's got politicians in its pay. There's a man today who stands for right. He don't care what $1 million say. Nader, Nader, he can lead. Matter if we sometimes disagree, 'cause he's honest in word and deed. And by God, that's good enough for me. And by God, that's good enough for me.
And that, of course, is an unofficial theme song for Ralph Nader's campaign, again written by Jeremy Alderson, host of The Nobody Show on WEOS-FM in New York State. Education is emerging as a major issue in the presidential campaign, and the debate over school choice promises to take center stage. Bob Dole favors giving parents the option of using government funds to send their kids to private school. President Clinton has said he supports school choice, by which he means parents should be able to choose which public school their children go to. A battle is brewing in New York City over the issue of public and private education. Republican Mayor Rudolph Giuliani is considering a proposal from the Roman Catholic Archdiocese to take 1,000 underperforming public school children and bring them into the city's Catholic schools. It would cost less per student than the city spends to educate students in public schools. And right now, all sorts of proposals are being considered because overcrowding, not only in New York City, but around the country, is at an all-time high. In New York City, there are some suggestions that in some schools, there are 40 and 50 kids in a classroom. Joining us to debate this issue are two people in our New York studio at WBAI. Norm Fruchter is director of the Institute for Education and Social Policy at New York University, and he's author of a new book coming out called Hard Lessons, Public Schools and Privatization. Peter Flanagan also joins us. He's a managing director of Dillon Reed & Company and chair of the Student Sponsor Partnership, chair of the advisory board of the Center for Educational Innovation. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Peter Flanagan? Can you lay out what the Archdiocese of New York has offered to the public school children of the city?
Sure, Amy, but first I'm going to say that the privatization of the public schools is a straw man. Nobody is suggesting the privatization of the public schools, nor is anybody suggesting that the public schools won't be the primary teachers of our children. What we're talking about is reforming the public schools so that, for instance, in New York, more than 48% of the kids graduate, so that in the inner city of New York, and that's where we work, more than 25% of the kids graduate. You go to South Bronx High, and that's about the percentage of the kids who get out of there after 4 years.
20%.
And if you look, yeah, and you look at the RAND report on what happened, it's a disgrace. You move those kids a few blocks, and they do very well. Same kids, according to RAND. So what we're talking about is making a system that in the inner city of New York is failing, making it a successful system. And you do that by breaking a monopoly. The problem with the public school system, particularly in the inner city of New York City, is that it's a monopoly, and as with all monopolies, it therefore doesn't serve its clients, the clients being the kids that we want to educate.
Explain what the student sponsor partnership is that you chair.
It is, in fact, a private voucher system, just like the one that Mayor Giuliani is now proposing, that's taken 1,000 kids from the bottom end of the public school system, moved them a few blocks to the private school system in high school, and has succeeded in graduating the great majority of them, doing a great deal better than the results of the public school system with the kids that were left behind.
Now, vouchers are being considered in cities around the country. In fact, aren't two states talking about a voucher system, Ohio and Wisconsin?
That's correct. And in Wisconsin, the courts have blocked it so far, so it is not yet underway. That is a public voucher system. The courts did not block it in Cleveland, Ohio, so the vouchers are now being distributed to inner city kids in Cleveland. You know, there's another experiment that people don't seem to recognize. For 2 years, there were vouchers in Puerto Rico, and that was blocked under the Puerto Rican Supreme Court with regard to the Puerto Rican Constitution, not the U.S. Constitution. The interesting thing about the results in Puerto Rico were that more kids used their voucher to go from one public school to another public school than did to go from the public schools to the private schools. And in fact, a number of, when they put the voucher system in Puerto Rico, a significant number of kids used the voucher to go from private schools to a public school of their choice. That breaks the monopoly. That gives the authority where it should give and the accountability where it should lie with the parents and the children. Parents know best where their children can be educated, not bureaucrats.
Norm Fruchter, what is the problem with this?
Well, the notion, I always find it interesting that we've got a public school monopoly, the notion that we've got a public school monopoly over education. The percentage of parents who send their kids to the public schools rather than private schools in the suburbs, as soon as you leave the cities, is much larger. If there's a public school monopoly, it operates just as well in suburban and upper middle class school systems as it does in inner city systems. And surprisingly there, people are actually satisfied with their public school systems and supportive of them. The problem is that in cities, and especially inner cities, what we've done over the last 25 years is we've pauperized our public school systems by refusing to support them. And so we've increased a failure rate to the kind of proportions that Mr. Flanagan talks about. Incidentally, if you look at graduation rates across 5 and 6 years in New York City high schools, they go up significantly beyond 48%. They go close to 60%. Not that kids should stay in high school for 5 or 6 years, but there's also no South Bronx High, but that's the problem that we've created is that as the middle class has moved out of our cities and our cities have become predominantly poor and predominantly, particularly in public school systems, serving students of color, the politicians of both parties and the infrastructure that should support public service of all kind, and particularly schools, has defunded public schools and allowed them to become the kind of repositories, in some cases warehouses for kids, that they are. There's no way that trying to create a voucher system or trying to break the so-called public school monopoly is going to solve that question, because there aren't enough other schools and placements in those other schools that kids could go to. The problem is to learn from the successes of the Catholic schools, because I think there are clear successes and clear lessons to be learned, and to build, to make the public schools smaller and to make them into the kinds of communities of value and communities dedicated to learning that successful public schools in New York City, and we've got lots of them, demonstrate. And it's a task that we've known we had to do in the public school system for a long time, but we've not had the political will to do it, especially because the public schools serve other people's kids.
What do you mean?
Well, again, something like less than 25% of all the families in New York City have kids in schools at all, and a lower percentage of them have kids in the public school system. The middle class that remains in New York has bought out of the public school system, and so politicians on both sides know that there is no penalty for cutting costs in the public school system, for refusing to build the buildings that we've known we needed. The overcrowding that we're facing today is an overcrowding that's been building in New York City for the past 10 years. Demographers knew it. The firm, I think private firm, incidentally, that's been doing the forecasting for the public school system has been putting out reports year after year saying this is what we need in terms of new school buildings. But politicians on both sides, both city and state, have refused to fund the money necessary to build the new school buildings. And so we're in the situation where we've got 40 and 50 kids in a class. You won't find those numbers in suburban school systems.
We have to break, but when we come back, we're also going to address the issue of just what does it mean to send kids to Catholic schools who aren't Catholic, or even Catholic kids who don't feel that schools are the place that they want to learn about religion. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. There is a drastic situation that is occurring in a number of cities around the country, and that is the crisis not only of quality of education in the public schools, but of overcrowding, tremendous overcrowding. And today we're taking on the issue of the privatization of public education, or at least sending some kids that would normally go to public school to Catholic schools in New York City to alleviate some of the problems. We're joined by Norm Fruchter, who is director of the Institute for Education and Social Policy at New York University. His new book is called Hard Lessons, Public Schools and Privatization. He has another book called Choosing Equality, The Case for Democratic Schooling. And we're also joined by Peter Flanagan, Managing Director of Dylan Reed & Company and Chair of the Student Sponsor Partnership. I want to say, as we talk about very dramatic crises that are going on today, there are also people who are pushing dramatic solutions. We have Larry Hamm, who we talked to a few weeks ago from New Jersey, who is head of the People's Organization for Progress. He is in the third week of his hunger fast protesting the lack of funds going to inner city schools throughout New Jersey. That fast is continuing. We'll see what happens with it. But right now, talking about New York City, Peter Flanagan, what about the concern of many that you're sending kids who are not necessarily Catholic to Catholic schools and they have to take religious instruction?
Well, Amy, first, I'd like to address that question of what Norm calls the defunding of our schools. On an absolute sense, the U.S. spends more money per kid in a K through 12 than any of the Western nations. On a relative sense, in the South Bronx and in Harlem, the New York City school system spends twice what the inner city Catholic school system does. So to say we're underfunding them when we're spending $8,000 versus $4,000 in the neighborhood, same neighborhood Catholic high school, is, I just think, a misstatement of fact. Now, you ask about, what about when we're sending kids to a Catholic school who doesn't, a kid who doesn't want to study religion? We are not sending them. They are choosing, or their parents are choosing to go there, and because in the inner city the poor are subject to a monopoly, it's quite correct, as Norm says, there's no monopoly where people are rich enough to pay their taxes and also to pay tuition. But in the inner city, the folks don't have that option. And so we are providing them that option if they wish it. They don't go there if they don't want to study religion. They don't go there if they don't like the kind of education they're going to get there.
But if public funds are used for it, isn't there a case to be made for separation of church and state?
There are no public funds being used for it now. In the case of the separation of church and state, the same kind of payment is made to the parent to choose the school they want, as is with Pell Grants, as was the GI Bill of Rights, where the GI was given money and he could spend it at the yeshiva or Notre Dame or City College, wherever he wanted. The same choice is made for daycare centers. A parent is given money for daycare, to buy daycare. They can buy it in the basement of a Protestant church, in a secular daycare, Catholic church, or a synagogue. That's that is the proposal for vouchers. Give the parents the right to choose, and they will choose that education that they think is best for their kid.
Norm Fruchter, what do you think about this issue?
Well, let me say a couple of things first. I'm a co-author on the book you're talking about. Carol Asher and Bob Byrne are my co-authors, and I didn't want to pose as the only author to Hard Lessons, Public Schools and Privatization. Just a word about the money thing. When you look at the OECD figures for how we spend money on education across Western industrialized nations...
OECD?
The Organization of Economic and Cultural Development. It's the major industrialized nations across the world. And they keep tabs on how much money per capita each country spends on public education. If you take K to 16 education, we're the leader. If you break it down and make it K-12, we come down the lower part of the list. We spend much, much, much more money as a society on the college portion of our education, of our students' education, than we do on K-12. We're not a leader in K-12 education, not at all. And in terms of the public-private school, the Catholic school monies, the New York Times article that actually talked about per-student distribution also talked about the difference in teacher salaries. If you look at teacher salaries in Catholic schools, they're about half what they are in public schools. If you equalize those salaries, you would find that the public school, Catholic school expenditure in New York City almost gets washed out. And New York City and Baltimore, by the way, are the two cities across the country that spend, and the only cities, that spend considerably less than the average per state that's spent on public school students. There isn't any way to argue that we're spending what we should be spending in New York City. We're spending about $8,000 per student. Even Newark, which you mentioned before, spends close to $10,000 per student, and by the way, gets very little for it. So,
are we talking about an issue of unions here as well, teachers' unions versus non-unionized Catholic schools?
Yeah, I mean, we could argue for a long time, and there's been lots of studies that have actually looked at Catholic school expenditure versus public school expenditure. I don't want to do that, though. I mean, I could do that quite well. The point I want to make is that we've been starving the New York City system of the resources that it needs. And even if you compare it to other school systems across the state, we get significantly less. Our class size is higher. Our enrichment and support teachers are lower. Guidance counselors are much less than they should be. Any single personnel line that you look at, since the 75 fiscal crisis, the New York City school system has gotten poorer. And we've done to our school buildings what we've done to our bridges and our other infrastructure. We've ignored them for so long that we've got a situation where, you know, in many school buildings, or certainly a significant number, there are multiple classrooms that can't be used because of water leaks and crumbling ceilings and electrical problems and other kinds of things. So, and Would that be tolerated in Catholic schools? No, it wouldn't. The interesting reason why it wouldn't is because, in my view, and the book I'm depending on here is a book by Tony Bright and Associates called Catholic Schools and the Common Good. What they argue is that Catholic schools essentially draw motivated parents. And the combination of motivated parents, a smaller scale, a concentration on basic core disciplines, helps to build a community of value that actually looks after most of the kids in the school. I think those are gains, and I think those are gains that characterize a growing number of public schools in the city that have restructured themselves into similar communities of value. And we didn't used to have to do that in the days when the public schools were crammed with kids, when there were 40, 50, 60 kids in a class, where discipline was close to absolute, and where if the teacher hit you in the morning and you went home and told your parent, the parent hit you as well and said, you know, what the teacher does is what I'm standing behind. That level of motivation and that level of commitment to public education is gone in New York City and a lot of cities across the country for a variety of reasons that have to do with the rupture between schools and what schools serve in terms of work. And until we build that back, what we've got to do is we've got to make schools into smaller communities of learning that work intrinsically. We know how to do that. We've done that in enough schools in New York City and other cities so that we know how to transform school systems into small schools that are communities of value, and that's the work that we've got to do, and we've got to fund them as well.
Well, I do want to go back to that issue of funding that Peter Flanagan raised. Peter Flanagan, the fact that nuns don't need as much money to support them, since they have supportive communities, they often live communally, do not have families, that teachers in the secular world need.
Amy, that used to be the case when in a happier day, there were lots of nuns, but that's not the case anymore. They represent something like 15% of the personnel in the Catholic inner city schools. The 85% is hired, and Norm is right. I think the relative figures are closer to 70% now than they are 50%. But let me give you a figure.
Are the teachers unionized in the Catholic schools?
They are, but they're not the national unions. They're not part of NEA or AFT. But the really interesting thing is, why are they teaching there if they'll only get 70% of the pay? They're teaching there because they get the psychic benefits of being able to help kids. It's interesting that in the most recent New York City labor negotiation, the teachers were excused from any responsibility for the hallways, the cafeteria, or the playgrounds. Now, you go to a Catholic school, those teachers are very much in evidence in the hallways, in the cafeteria, and the playgrounds, because it's a total responsibility for the kids. That's why parents choose, as Norm says, in most cases at considerable sacrifice to pay tuition, and in some cases, the parents aren't involved, like the 1,000 kids that we at the Student Sponsor Partnership have in Catholic high schools. There's no parental involvement there at all. The kid who tried to go to a better public high school, like most of the kids do, couldn't get in. So the public school counselor sent them to us, and we gave him a voucher.
What about the issue?
And that kid succeeds.
What about the issue of expulsion? Catholic schools can expel their students. In fact, the Catholic schools in New York have expelled thousands. The public schools cannot.
I don't know where you got your statistic that the Catholic schools in New York have expelled thousands, because my experience is that is absolutely not the case. They have the right, and of course that right is an effective part of their discipline. The public schools drop them out. So it is interesting that a much larger percent of the kids that start the Catholic schools finish them than they do in the public schools. The expulsion issue, I think, is another straw man, because most of those kids stay and graduate. It's interesting that it used to be that the public schools also could expel disruptive students, and I've heard it said that the public schools are going to try and reinstall that, and I think they should have the right to do that in extreme cases.
What kind of religious instruction does go on in the Catholic school? How much of the day is spent doing it, and what is taught?
One, Catholicism is taught. One course out of the total curriculum, one session every day, and prayers at the beginning of the day.
Norm,
let me say again, If you don't want it, you shouldn't go there. It's absolutely free choice. In the same way that all the rest of our society exercises a choice as to what they want, whether it's housing, medical aid, anything else that they do, they, the consumer, makes the choice, except in this one instance where neither the parent nor the kid has anything to say about where he goes to school.
But isn't it true that there is a decline in the school population of the Catholic schools in New York, and having 1,000 more kids would certainly help the schools get by?
There was a decline. That's been reversed in the last couple of years. The enrollment in Catholic schools have been going up. As a matter of fact, if we put 1,000 kids and paid their tuition, it would not help but rather hurt the schools, because each of those schools, that's not correct. It would certainly be all right, but every kid gets some kind of a scholarship from the Catholic Church, because the tuition doesn't pay for the entire cost of his education, his or her education.
Norm Fruchter, as we wrap up, you talked about what communities of value that have to be created in smaller, more decentralized schools. In these last few minutes, can you talk about what you see as the major problems of the public schools and the solutions you see to them, how you achieve these things?
Yeah, very quickly, education is different than a marketplace phenomenon. It's not simply a relationship between a consumer and a good. And we've always accepted in this society and in most societies that education is a public good, and it has dimensions that benefit the whole society as well. That makes the job of the public schools more complicated than the job of the Catholic schools. Quick example, the courts and Congress have established a series of entitlements for children with disabilities that the public schools have to meet. The Catholic schools and other private schools may or may not meet those concerns, but they're not vulnerable to any court of law if they don't, which the public school is. And so the public schools, if you will, are encumbered with a set of responsibilities that I think they should meet that are often more difficult for them to carry out, and involve them in sometimes in layers of bureaucracy that make everybody's job more difficult. The real task for the public schools is to try to figure out, as you said, how to create decentralized schools that are different, that serve different needs, that allow a level of public choice, which is much more than we have now, but also go on trying to maintain the public goods in terms of preparation for citizenship, in terms of the development and the learning about a common culture, in terms of the teaching about not only the heritage of this society, but also the ways that our diverse constituencies have experienced American society. We need the public schools to do that, and we need a debate about the best ways that they can do that, which has to be a public debate rather than imagining that as a series of individual consumer choices. The difficulty is that in order to meet entitlements and to carry out those responsibilities, we've created a level of bureaucracy which winds up encumbering the public school system, and we've got to change that.
Let me ask both you and Peter Flanagan this last minute. If you think that the debate at the presidential race level of vouchers is going to advance the discussion of the problems of public education any more in these next few weeks?
I think that it will bring the question to the foreground. I don't think it will elucidate it, because I think political debates, unfortunately, are very short, one-sentence arguments, and it makes it difficult for people really to think about the issues and see how we work our way through them.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that the issues of why do we need a public school system, if indeed we need it, and what is it for, and what relationship does it have to the society we have and the society we want, is not going to be raised. Nor is the issue of the difference between marketplace choice and public good going to be raised at all. And so the issue gets reduced to competing, I'd say, visions. They're not quite visions, of choice when what's actually at stake is much more complicated.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Norm Fruchter, director of the Institute for Education and Social Policy at New York University. His new book, he co-authors, is called Hard Lessons, Public Schools and Privatization. And Peter Flanagan has also been our guest. He is chair of the Student Sponsor Partnership and chair of the Advisory Board of the Center for Educational Innovation. If you'd like to make a comment on this discussion, we'd welcome your comments. We'll play some on the air. Our number is 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer in Washington has been Ken Mason. In New York, Errol Maitlin. Tomorrow, we'll be discussing U.S. Army intelligence manuals used to train Latin American military officers at an Army school in the United States, advocating execution, torture, and blackmail. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Thank you.